This is the first day of this October 2014 seven-day session, and we'll turn to an oldie but goodie text called The Practice of Zen. And this is translated and edited by C.C. Chang, Chen Chi Chang. I have kind of a sentimental attachment to this, the stories and accounts and teachings in here, because this was one of the, I don't know, four or five Zen texts in English that Roshi Kaplow would have to rotate through in the 60s and 70s. And haven't done it in a while, so I'm going to turn to these are all Chinese masters, these entries here. I'm going to turn to what's called Zen Master Shui Yan's story. Time does not wait for people. Swiftly the next incarnation will be upon you. Therefore, why do you not try to understand Zen and practice in earnest with a humble mind to make it transparently clear throughout? How fortunate you are to live here, surrounded by famous mountains and great lakes. How lucky you are to find yourself in a world full of teachings and great masters. Your monastery is clean and neat, the food good and nourishing, water and firewood abound nearby. If you do not use this hard-to-find opportunity to understand Zen clearly and thoroughly, you are squandering your life. You are sinking in self-abandonment and willingly abasing yourself to become a low, stupid person. If you feel ignorant about this teaching, why do you not question the elders extensively and ponder on what they say to discover the meaning? And it doesn't take, he's addressing his monks here, of course, but it doesn't take a lot of imagination to realize that we who are practicing in the United States, and especially those of us here at Chapin Mill, have found ourselves in absolutely superb conditions for practice, and compared to most of the world's population, we are not only prosperous, but because we are, we have this opportunity. Our good karma has brought us here to this place at this time, where all of the conditions are just perfect for practice. You don't have to worry about war on our own soil. It seems to be a terrible problem in so much of the world. War or religious conflict, ethnic conflict. We have, as he said, we have such good, nourishing food, comfortable rooms. The surroundings are ideal for letting go and letting one sink into the mind. He continues, I had joined the, I had become a monk at the age of 5. When I overheard my teacher discussing this matter with his guests and visitors, then I knew that there was such a thing as Zen, and immediately I had faith in it. Soon I began to learn how to meditate. At 16, I was ordained. So that first line, the line actually reads, I had joined the priesthood at the age of 5. Well, he became a novice, I suppose. At 16, I was ordained, and at 17, I started on pilgrimage. At the dwelling place of the Master Yuan of Shuanglin, I joined the Congregation for Meditation. From dawn to sunset, I never left room or court. Courts, a classically built Chinese monastery would have three successive courts, an inner courtyard, and then an outer one and a middle one. So this is quite significant. From dawn to sunset, I never left room, his room, or the courtyard that his room was situated on. So it sounds like he didn't even go out in the woods. People who like to take walks during sesshin, during break periods, are welcome to do so. I wonder how many of those of you who take walks are aware of how easily the mind can get caught in thoughts as you're wandering on the road or elsewhere, gazing out at the scenery. This master seemed to understand that he didn't want to expose himself to even that degree of possible distraction. So he kept himself in his room or in the courtyard. He says, even when I entered the dormitory, I just crossed my hands within my big sleeves and looked straight ahead without seeing anything to the right or to the left. I fixed my eyes on a spot about 3 feet ahead of me. In the beginning, I absorbed myself in the word wu. Wu is the original Chinese word that in Japanese is mu. So, same thing. I absorb myself in the word mu. One day I suddenly turned my mind inward, seeking to discover where and how the thought first arose. Instantly I felt as if my mind had become frozen. It became clear, serene, and limpid, neither moving nor shaking. The whole day seemed like a passing second. I did not even hear the sounds of drums and bells, which occurred at regular intervals in the monastery. I sometimes get the question in Doksan, am I supposed to be so in touch with everything going on in the Zendo and outside that I hear everything, every sound? Some people even seem to think that's their job. Their job is to miss nothing, miss no sound that's going on around them. But for someone practicing on Mu or another, some other basic koans, that's not your job to hear everything. There is another practice we might call just hearing. That is was reportedly the practice of Guanyin Kanon, and how she came to awakening. But other than that practice, you may sometimes hear everything very clearly and vividly, and at other times you may not. And that's not your concern, whether you are or aren't. Now, if your mind is swarming with thoughts so thickly that you don't hear anything, well, that's something you'd want to notice in terms of noticing the thoughts and getting back to the koan. But one can get into peculiar states of mind, even in deep concentration, where you lose awareness of what's going on around you. If that isn't something to aspire to, we're not trying to block out sounds and other sense experiences, nor are we trying to contrive to be aware of them in itself. The awareness for someone working on mu is on mu, not on the sounds or sights or smells or tastes or touch or anything else. It's just mu. And then in concentrating on mu, there may be times when you are very much aware of things around you and other times when you may not be. Here he describes, "I did not even hear the sounds of drums and bells." They may have had to send the monitors into his room to get him out of there into the Zenda. When I was 19, I stayed at the Lin Yin Monastery as a visiting monk. Meanwhile, I had received a letter from Chu Chao, which said that none of these... there's no explanation of who these people are. I had received a letter from Chu Chao, which said, "Dear Chin, your Zen is a dead Zen. That which you have been working on is like dead water, useless. Your work is to divide activity and inactivity into two." He's saying that's what you've been doing erroneously, dividing activity and inactivity. And this most of you have heard many times of the importance of making our practice a continuous practice, not just something we do while we're sitting, but which we carry with us through our everyday activities. The important thing in Zen work is to arouse the feeling of inquiry doubt. So this is how this particular translator renders what we often refer to as doubt or questioning. This doubt, of course, is not the doubt of skepticism, and it's not the doubt that is the opposite of faith, but it's the doubt with a capital D, the questioning, the inquiring, which is the other side of faith. It goes with the faith. If there is strong faith, then out of that comes questioning. He translates it as inquiry doubt. I'll just make it doubt, which is how we usually, most translators make it. A small doubt will bring a small enlightenment, and a greater doubt will bring forth a great enlightenment. That was the end of the words that Chu Chao wrote to our this monk who became a master, Shui Yun. And then Shui Yun says, "Chu Chao's words hit the mark." So apparently this Shui Yan had slipped into a kind of a trance, a dead calm, which is always a danger in Zen practice. We can get lulled into a dead calm, and it can be quite seductive, especially in our ordinary life is very busy and active, then we can too easily allow ourselves to sink into and remain stuck in this dead calm. He says, I then went to Chin Tzu Monastery and banded together with seven monks of Dharma there. We vowed to meditate in a most strict manner. We put aside our quilts and refused to lie down on our beds. This was a kind of somewhat ascetic practice in China. It was widely known. You read it in the accounts of some of the other Chinese masters where they won't let themselves lie down at night. We put aside our quilts and refused to lie down on our beds. The chief monk, Brother Xu, remained outside our room. Every day when he sat down on the meditation seat, he appeared as steady and immovable as an iron pole thrust into the ground. When he walked, he opened his eyes and dropped his arms so that he still looked like an iron pole. No one could become intimate or talk with him. Now, this is a really strict discipline that this chief monk was following. Someone who's really committed to seeing through birth and death, and so who has no interest in idle chatter, telling stories and anecdotes, indulging in chit-chat with the other monks. It's very rare, someone with that kind of commitment. But he must have been a good model for these monks. For 2 years, I did not lie down. Let me repeat that. For 2 years, I did not lie down. Then one day I became so tired that I gave up and lay down and had a good sleep. Fair enough. 2 months passed before I collected myself and was ready to work again. The relaxation I had had in those 2 months refreshed me. I felt very vigorous and lively. From this experience, I learned that if one wants to understand this matter, he cannot go completely without sleep. Completely without sleep. A sound sleep at midnight is necessary to refresh oneself. Can't help but wonder when he says this, a sound sleep at midnight, when it is that he would be waking up. 2 hours, 1 hour, 4 hours. This matter of sleep, how much sleep to get, during Sesshin especially, is a very sensitive, touchy kind of issue. We don't want to use this opportunity of Sesshin to sleep as much as we normally do, certainly. We're just losing out on the opportunity to sit, to do the sit in these ideal conditions with the support of other people. But how little sleep to get, how much to cut down on sleep, has to be the decision of every person. I tend to think that most people need at least a couple of hours, maybe three. When I say need, I mean they're not likely to be able to do effective zazen with less than 2 or 3 hours of sitting in most nights. And I say I tend to think that. I'm not sure about that because there are cases of people, members of our own center here, who have gone much with much less sleep and come to awakening And you can't help but connect the two. You can't help but see a causal connection between the two. The most recent case that comes to mind is someone who, in a seven-day session, got up at the middle of the night of, say, like 2 a.m. on Thursday, and then didn't sleep again for the rest of the session. And that person had a breakthrough, had an awakening experience. The tricky thing is that if the lack of sleep is compromising your sitting, if you're just really so dreadfully tired that you can't I almost said think straight, but that's all right if you're not thinking straight. But if you're really so depleted, then you're not really helping yourself by just forcing yourself to stay awake on the mat. But, and this is a big but, we can be dreadfully tired, and yet through great effort we can pierce through that tiredness and come out the other side feeling quite wide awake. And as we'll hear, there's in his account, he goes into this more. I'll just continue. One day I noticed the chief monk, Shu, by the balustrade. This was the first time I had had an opportunity to speak with him. "For the past year I've wanted to talk to you. Why do you always avoid me?" I asked. Shu replied, "One who really practices the Tao has no time even to cut his nails. Who has the leisure to talk to you?" I then asked him what to do about the drowsiness and errant thoughts which afflicted me. He said, "These things happen because you are not earnest enough. You should sit erect on your seat, keep your spine straight, make your whole body and mind become one koan, and pay no attention to drowsiness or wild thoughts." Well, this is good orthodox advice. Pay no attention to drowsiness or wild thoughts. Pay attention only to one's practice, the koan or the breath one is working on. You may well be aware of the drowsiness. You may well be aware of the thoughts, but your focus is on the practice itself, the particular practice you're working on. Sitting erect is a way of staying more alert. If your back is slumping, you're more likely to succumb to drowsiness. Keep your spine straight and drawn up. Lengthen your spine. Sit tall, and you're more likely to be alert. And above all, keep your eyes open. It's practically impossible to do good zazen if your eyes are closing. Working in accord with his instructions, I unknowingly forgot both my body and mind, even their very existence. For 3 days and three nights, my mind stayed so serene and clear that I never closed my eyes for a single moment. On the afternoon of the third day, I walked through the three gates of the monastery as if I were sitting. Again, I came across Shu. "What are you doing here?" he asked. "Working on the Tao," I answered. He then said, "What is this you call the Tao?" The Tao, spelled T-A-O, is the way, the Dharma. "What is this you call the Tao?" Not able to answer him, I became more confused and perplexed. With the intention of meditating further, I turned back toward the meditation hall. But accidentally, I met Shu again. He's like gum on the bottom of your shoe. He said, just open your eyes and see what it is. After this admonishment, I was even more anxious to return to the meditation hall than before. As I was just going to sit down, something broke abruptly before my face as if the ground were sinking away. I wanted to tell how I felt, but I could not express it. Nothing in this world can be used as a simile to describe it. Immediately, I went to find Shu. As soon as he saw me, he said, "Congratulations, congratulations." Holding my hand, he led me out of the monastery. This, by the way, is a kind of a cultural thing that you discover when you're in China. It's quite normal for I don't know about generally, but certainly with two monks, one would their friends, one would hold the other's hand walking somewhere. I remember when we were at Shaolin Temple, that's Bodhidharma's temple in China, with the group and Roshi Kaplow and a group organized by him. The old abbot of Shaolin was showing us through, and he took Roshi's hand, and he was in his 80s at the time. Holding my hand, he led me out of the monastery. We walked along the river dike, which was full of willow trees. I looked up at the sky and down at the earth. I actually felt that all phenomena and manifestations, the things I saw with my eyes and heard with my ears, the things that disgusted me, including the passion desires and the blindnesses, all flowed out from my own bright, true, and marvelous mind. During the next fortnight, 2 weeks, no moving phenomena appeared in my mind. So far, so good, but listen up. Unfortunately, at that time, I had no Zen master to instruct me. Thus, I mistakenly lingered in such a state for many years. This is the so-called state wherein, quote, the view is not thorough, therefore it hinders genuine understanding. I could not hold the view while sleeping. At this stage, I could grasp the koans that were intelligible, but whenever I met any of those impenetrable, silver mountain-like, and iron wall-like koans, I could not understand them at all. Although I had practiced for many years under my deceased teacher, Wu Chun, none of his private discussions or public talks struck my heart. None of the Zen books or sutras meant much to me. This obstacle was an oppression within my heart and breast for 10 years. Then one day, when I was walking in the hall of Ten Mao Monastery, I lifted my head and saw a cypress tree standing before me. Suddenly, in a flash, I understood. The experience heretofore gained and the obstacle weighing upon my heart and breast all melted away. The feeling was akin to experiencing the bright sun shining suddenly into a dark room. From that time on, I had no doubts about birth and death, no questions about Buddha and the patriarchs. So it's interesting, isn't it, that he had this experience that that prompted even this iron pole, the head monk Shu, to say, "Congratulations, congratulations," and yet he somehow was attached to it in some way. It's not clear. entirely clear from this. We could say probably that it was Kensho, that first experience. It was somewhat freed him up to practice more deeply after that, which led then to a real thoroughgoing realization. Here's another story by Zen Master Meng Shan. I'm afraid I'm not aware of what time period all this is. I think it may have been in the 1900s or maybe earlier. I'll see if I can find by tomorrow when this was. I'm almost sure it wasn't in the 20th century. So, Zen Master Meng Shan's story. When I was 20 years old, I already knew of this matter, Zen. From that time on until I was 32, I practiced with some 18 teachers to learn how actually to practice Zen. Nevertheless, I received no clear-cut teaching from them. Now, what does that mean? It's 12 years he's talking about. He practiced with 18 elders, it says. I made that teachers. Let's keep it as elders. I received no clear-cut teaching from them. Does he mean that he received no explanation from them in detail exactly how to do the practice? Well, that would be quite normal, because we can only give people so much in the way of instruction, and then they have to do the rest themselves. They have to find their own way. Or did he mean that he never really had a chance to get any formal teaching, instruction from them? We're just left wondering. Later, I practiced with the elder of Wanshan, who taught me to observe the wu word, again, mu. In doing so, he said that one should, in the 12 periods of a day, be ever alert like a cat waiting to catch a mouse, or like a hen intent on hatching an egg, never letting up on the task. The 12 periods each would be 2 hours. This is the way they divided the daily round in the monasteries, is these 12 two-hour periods. Until one is fully and thoroughly enlightened, he should keep on working uninterruptedly like a mouse gnawing at a coffin. If one can keep practicing in such a manner, in time he will definitely discover the way. Following these instructions, I meditated and contemplated diligently day and night for 18 days. Then, while I was drinking a cup of tea, I suddenly understood the purport of Buddha's holding up the flower and of Mahakashyapa's smile to him. Delight overwhelmed me. This is a koan in the Mumon Kan, number 6. Delight overwhelmed me. I questioned 3 or 4 elders about my experience, but they said nothing. Several of the elders told me to identify my experience with the ocean seal samadhi and to disregard all else. Their advice led me to an easy confidence in myself. I don't know that I would ever suggest that someone identify their experience in this kind of a way as the ocean seal samadhi. It sounds very lofty and exalted, and it would be hard for someone fresh out of an experience not to have that go to his head. And I think that's what he means. Their advice led me to an easy confidence in myself. 2 years after this, you can tell we're just getting the sketchiest features of these autobiographies. 2 years after this, in the month of July, I contracted dysentery at Chongqing in Sichuan province. My bowels moved 100 times a day and brought me to the brink of death. All my former understanding became useless, and the so-called ocean seal samadhi did not help me in the least. I had a body, but I could not move. I had a mouth, but I could not speak. I lay down just waiting for death. All the karmas and other fearful hallucinations appeared simultaneously before me. All the karmas, it's a funny translation, meaning all kinds of mental, physical formations based on past karma were exposed or pressed in on the mind, and other makyo appeared simultaneously before me. Frightened, puzzled, and lost, I felt crushed, annihilated under pressures and miseries. So when we do a memorial service after someone has died, it's one purpose of the memorial service is to, in addressing the deceased, to help him or her steady the mind through what may very well be, for any of us, might be old residual karma that then comes up and in the face of which we are vulnerable because we are deceased. And we don't have the ego strength of our conscious mind. In that state, we are more susceptible to losing our way in the face of such makyo and what can be frightening forms. And sure enough, here this Mengshan. Mengshan found himself overcome by these things. With the thought of approaching death before me, I forced myself to make a will and so dispose of all my worldly affairs. This accomplished, I slowly pulled myself up, burned a full censer of incense, and seated myself steadily on a high seat. There I prayed silently to the three precious ones. No footnote there. Three precious ones could be Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, the three jewels, and the gods in the heavens, repenting before them of all the harmful deeds I had committed in life. Let's just pause and just comment on prayer. People sometimes ask whether there's prayer as part of Zen practice. Well, apparently there is, because that's what Mengshan was doing here. It's not something that has any significant place in orthodox pure Zen practice, because most prayer, if not all prayer, is petitionary prayer, wanting something from someone. God, or in this case, gods in the heavens. I don't know what that means. But Zen points to this mind that is where there is no other from whom we need anything. But neither do we want to think less of Mengshan for praying in these very desperate conditions. He was facing death. And until we face death, any one of us faces death, who knows what we would do? And, in fact, whatever it was, you can just say it was just some psychological benefit he got from it, but whatever it was, it worked. I then made my last petition. If my life is about to end, I wish through the power of prajna and a sober state of mind that I may be reborn in a favorable place wherein I may become a monk at an early age. If by chance I recover from this sickness, I will renounce the world, become a monk, and strive to bring enlightenment to people everywhere. So this may really have been the key, the turning point for him. Not the prayer, but the vow to devote himself for the welfare of all beings. Not just wanting to be healed for himself because he was scared to death, but then making this vow of wanting to benefit others. Having made this vow, I then took up the mu word and observed it inwardly. Before long, my bowels rolled and twisted a number of times, but I ignored them. After I had sat for a long while, I felt my eyelids become fixed steadfastly. Again, a long period of time elapsed in which I did not feel the presence of my body at all. There was nothing but the koan continuously presenting itself in my mind. It was not until night that I rose from my seat. I had half recovered from my illness. I sat again and meditated until after midnight. By then, my recovery was complete. Both my body and mind felt comfortable and light. I don't know who could hear stories like this and not find their faith bolstered, strengthened in the power of mind, in the power of spiritual intention, the power of the vow. The power of the mind to overcome physical difficulties. Most people would focus on drugs or remedies or other things, and no doubt, well, not no doubt, but quite possibly, this Meng Shan had already gone through that and it hadn't worked. So out of desperation, he summoned all the faith he had and just threw himself into this mu. It works also with physical pain. You don't have to be on the verge of death. You can be facing serious physical pain in the Zendo, and if you can commit yourself thoroughly enough, faithfully enough to the practice, and the practice alone, the mu or the breath, you can suddenly find yourself free of the pain. Our time is up now. We'll have to resume this tomorrow, and we'll recite the four vows.